This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Laura Musikansky and John DeGraff. Laura is executive director and co-founder of the Happiness Initiative, a former executive director of Sustainable Seattle, and author of the book, How to Account for Sustainability. John is executive director of Take Back Your Time, a co-founder of the Happiness Initiative, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and co-author of the books Affluenza and What's the Economy For, Anyway? Laura Musikansky and John DeGraff are here today to give us an update on the Happiness Initiative and to tell us how happiness is key to a more sustainable future. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Would you remind us, what is the Happiness Initiative and how did it come about?
Sure. The Happiness Initiative is a grassroots organization. Our goal is essentially to change our way of thinking, to change, if you would, our meme from money-focused to well-being-focused. So that's going to take a bottoms-up approach and a top-down approach, and we're the bottoms-up piece of that grassroots activism. Anybody can go to our website, can get that subjective indicator of well-being and use it for any level that they want. So that really goes to, what is the Happiness Initiative? We're offering the tools and the resources for subjective measures of well-being based on the model of Bhutan.
Would you elaborate on how happiness plays a role in environmental protection and efforts to move toward a more equitable society?
Yeah, I think it's very key that we understand that we can't just simply grow on forever. I mean, it's very popular in the country to talk about that the answer to sort of every problem is to grow the economy. But there are some problems with that because we're already, in a sense, in overshoot. We're already using more resources and providing more waste than can be handled by the earth by a factor of about half over what the planet will absorb. And if everyone, for example, were to suddenly adopt the United States lifestyle, we'd need five planets to make that possible. So we've got to be thinking about a different way forward that doesn't require limitless growth. But that doesn't have to be a sad way of life, an austere way of life, an unhappy way of life. And what the Happiness Initiative does and work around happiness is it allows us to see that the things that make us happy, the things that improve our well-being, many of them have to do with non-material things, social connection, community, appreciation of nature, arts and culture, these kind of things. It's not all about the stuff. And I think that's a lesson that our society in particular needs to understand.
And I'll just follow up with that answer. John comes from the environmental movement. I come from the sustainability movement. And there was something missing, I think, in both of those movements of really connecting our hearts to the environment and connecting ourselves to each other. And that's where the happiness movement picks up. So it's not like we're leaving the environmental movement behind or the sustainability movement behind. We're encompassing that, this movement is. And it helps people to really see that connection between each other and between the environment, both the natural and the built environment.
How well does happiness fit with our national goals historically here in the United States?
Well, if we go back to our founding fathers, it fits perfectly with our national goals as they were expressed by the founding fathers. We all know that Jefferson wrote into the Declaration of Independence those famous words, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What fewer people know is that Jefferson and several of the other founding fathers, including George Washington, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin, all stated on a number of occasions that happiness, in fact, was the sole purpose of government. The sole purpose of government was increasing the happiness of the people. So it is part of the tradition. And to those people who say that government has nothing to do with happiness or vice versa, they need to tell that to the founding fathers because the founding fathers were apparently clueless about that fact.
What's important is to remember that when we talk about happiness, we're citing Jefferson, right, in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And there he was talking about eudaimonia, which is the idea of living well. The other thing that I think is really important to keep in mind is, have we confused democracy with capitalism? So we are talking about a democratic government. We are talking about government. We're not talking about the purpose of capitalism so much. That's a transformation that comes along the way when we transform our society. Then hopefully the idea of capitalism will change so that it's not just about money, but also about well-being of the people and the planet.
How is happiness and well-being being measured? What do you mean by happiness?
So when we talk about happiness, we're talking about a subjective and objective measure of well-being. And honestly, we should probably be using the term well-being. That's really the scientific term for it. But if we use that term, people would be like, ho-hum, a bunch of health officials and scientists talking about the next thing. So for the scientists out there and the academics, we're really talking about well-being. And when we say happiness or well-being, or I think of it also as a holistic way of sustainability, we're looking at domains of happiness. So there's two aspects of the domains of happiness. There's what you usually think of when you think of happiness, which is the subject of well-being. Is this life worth living? An affect. How do you feel today? Do you feel happy? Do you feel sad? And then there's the conditions of happiness. And those are the things that influence you. So those are the things that you may not have complete control over. So you may have control over what you're thinking, but not necessarily the complete control over your society, your government, and your economy. We worked with a group of scientists from San Francisco State University to look at the domains of happiness as Bhutan described them, and then added one more domain so that we really have what we think is and what is said to be the most efficient and comprehensive approach to what happiness is.
And we should point out clearly what happiness is not in our view, and that's momentary pleasure. This is not about measuring hedonism or momentary pleasure. This is about lifelong satisfaction, about a life well lived. The Bhutanese model for this is virtually identical to that of Thomas Jefferson, and it ultimately probably goes back to Aristotle or to Buddha.
And so when we say a life well lived, we include what is being done in your environment, right? Do you feel like your environment is toxic or is it healthy? Do you have access to the environment? Do we include the government? Do you feel like your government is listening to you? Do you have an opportunity to participate in your government? The community. So do you feel like you have a loving, supportive group of family and friends? Do you have opportunities to engage in your community, to volunteer, to do things for other people? Are you doing that? And do you feel like you can trust? Do you feel like you're safe in your community, as well as other areas of happiness? Those are the three that, when you take action in them, really will lead to greater happiness in terms of not necessarily momentary pleasure, but sort of that feeling of I'm living a life that really feels good to live.
This comes from really the work that Bhutan did. And Bhutan, of course, proclaimed the idea of gross national happiness some 40 years ago. But what they've done is they've, over the years, invited many scientists to their country and worked with them to see what are the kinds of conditions that really do match life satisfaction over the long run. And they include the things that Laura mentioned. They also include things like time balance, having enough time, not feeling stressed constantly. They include things like good health. So it's a broader perspective on the good life than what we've traditionally assumed in the United States, which really is this thing called gross national product or gross domestic product.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Laura Musikansky and John DeGraff. Our topic is the Happiness Initiative. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you give us an update on your survey results, what the most recent results have shown, and also how many people have taken it?
Right. So we have about 1,000 people a month are taking the survey right now. The survey results are all up online. We did a random sampling a year and a half ago, and the results show a general trend down. Just very small. It may not be scientifically significant because these are all opt-in. So these are people who are opting to take the survey. However, there is a slow trend down in the numbers. We consistently score, all of us. Of course, there's always some exceptions, lowest in time balance. So I want to hand it to John on that point and what that means, both here locally in Seattle and what that means nationally, and what that means in terms of how you live your life.
We do find that Americans are increasingly pressed for time, stressed for time. We don't work quite as long as we did before the recession began. That's one effect of the recession, is that overall hours have gone down a bit. But lives still tend to be, for people, very, very stressed. They're filled up with things, all the new electronic technologies, the pressures that we have even to be working when we're at home and on the weekends and so forth. There's a clear connection between this kind of stress and the stress we feel as Americans and life satisfaction. And so that's one thing that we look at. But I think one of the findings that was most unique in our survey and new in the happiness research is that we're finding right now is that among the least happiest part of the population in the United States is 19 to 24-year-olds. And they were normally seen to be among the happiest. In fact, happiness was kind of a curve where younger people were happy when you were kind of in middle age and at the height of raising a family and all of that. That's when things got toughest and scores were lowest. And then they go up again to seniors. But now we also find this cohort of young people facing college debt and a lack of job prospects also feeling much less happy than the population as a whole.
So time balance is on the lowest end. How about the highest end?
It's material well-being. So we rate ourselves quite high in that, as well as psychological well-being. So part of this is a cultural thing, is that Americans tend to perceive themselves to be happy, which is a good thing in terms of, is this life worth living and do I feel like I have purpose in my life?
John, would you now tell us about your trip to Bhutan that you took recently and tell us about how indicators are being used there and the progress that's being made in using the indicators for public policy?
Sure. Just about 6 weeks ago, I had the wonderful opportunity of going to Bhutan to be part of a group of people from around the world who are working with the government of Bhutan in developing some materials for the United Nations, which is very seriously considering Bhutan's proposal to make happiness the goal of governments and the goal of development, and to encourage all member nations of the UN to find ways to measure that. One thing I found in Bhutan was certainly a generally happy country, although a very poor country, but a country in which I saw no beggars, no homeless people, despite the poverty, and general happiness among the population. What Bhutan is doing, though, that is, I think, most fascinating is that they are taking so serious this measurement of gross national happiness. It's even instilled in their constitution that the goal of their government is gross national happiness. And they are measuring this in very detailed ways, surveying thousands of people in the country, long surveys. It's an incredible process, really, really amazing. I mean, people tend to chuckle when they hear the term gross national happiness, but I can assure you, this is no joke. In Bhutan, they are really finding ways to measure the well-being of their population that go far beyond anything we've attempted here.
How well do their indicators compare with the ones here? Are they fairly similar or are there differences as well?
There are differences and similarities. They're much more complex than what we're using in our survey, but they use essentially the same domains. In fact, we followed their lead in picking out, you know, what we would measure, but their measurements are more, they've put a lot of resources behind it. Their surveys are very, very detailed. You know, they take 4 hours to fill out and not everyone does them, but they're taken out to villages around the country and a random sampling of thousands of people is gathered in the country. So what they're doing is very similar and it's along the same lines, but they've just gone a lot farther with it.
The chief difference is their survey is about 4 hours and ours is about 12 minutes. So what we did is we took their survey, and the way you use a subjective measure of well-being or you create one is that you don't make things up. So we took what they did and we distilled it down so we have a scientifically, internally and externally validated tool that people can use based on Bhutan's tool.
What are some specific policy decisions that were influenced by the happiness indicators in Bhutan?
Well, they have what they call a policy tool or a policy lens, and they have a team of people. They're called the Gross National Happiness Commission. 24 people, they come from many walks of life, many kinds of expertise. And they actually evaluate all major legislative proposals that run through Bhutan's parliament, not little tiny stuff, but the big stuff, is subjected to a happiness analysis based on the domains of happiness and has to achieve a certain score in order to pass. An example of two things recently that did not pass, one was Bhutan was considering whether or not to join the World Trade Organization. They decided not to based on a happiness analysis of what that would do for their country. Another important one was that they were asked to build a major hydroelectric project that would have supplied power to India and brought in considerable amount of money to Bhutan. It certainly would have been a plus on the material side of things for Bhutan, but they decided it would have very negative effects on their environment, on their culture. It would displace people, and that on balance, it wasn't worth it. They're now considering, most recently, the prime minister just put down an edict that they are not going to do certain types of mining, even though those mines would be very profitable for the country's GDP because of the impacts on the environment.
Another example that I love is that Bhutan is a Buddhist country, And they did their second survey, and they found that only 1% of the people were meditating or actually practicing meditation. So they put in place a policy where children are now taught mindfulness in classes in their school. So I think that's a wonderful one. And Bhutan is also, I think, probably the only country that now has the goal of being 100% organic in agriculture.
They also keep 70% of their forest cover, and that's a target they will not go below, keeping 70% of the country in forest, at least 50% of the country fully environmentally protected, almost in a state of wilderness. So it's pretty amazing that they have made these decisions, which are quite costly for a country as poor as Bhutan. And most countries like them would probably just say, wow, we've got all this stuff and we can develop it. But Bhutan is saying, no, we need to think about the long run, the future generations. You know, I came away very impressed.
But I would say that if you do your research, you'll see that there's some dark sides of Bhutan, as there is with any country, including the treatment of Nepali. But Bhutan has been very clear that they don't see themselves as the paradigm. They're not the Shangri-La. They're experimenting, and they're trying something new. So it's for us to take up and see how we can play with this and create that new way.
One point to make, too, is that it is in Bhutan's constitution that they must remain a net carbon sink. And they are right now one of the very few countries, maybe the only country on Earth, that actually sequesters more carbon with its forests than it produces through its industry. And it is part of the rule that they will never produce more carbon dioxide than they sequester. So they are not contributing to global warming. They are, however, suffering from global warming caused by people elsewhere because their Himalayan glaciers are melting and causing serious flooding in parts of the country.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Laura Musikansky and John DeGraff. Our topic is the Happiness Initiative. To what extent are happiness or well-being indicators being used in other parts of the world?
I think the best example right now is the UK, where their Bureau of Stats has done their second survey, and you can go online and look at, they call it their happiness wheel, and where they've surveyed something like upwards of 250,000 people. And then they have a set of objective and subjective indicators that you can look at how are people, where do they perceive themselves to be hurting and thriving? And then what do the objective indicators show, sort of balance that picture. In the UK, they're taking a sort of a blended bottoms-up and top-down approach. So the nonprofit that they're working with closely is Actions for Happiness, which is educating people around happiness. I've heard some rumors of some policies. We'll see what happens.
How about other parts of the United States?
We're working with cities and grassroots activists and campuses across the United States. We have about 30 different campuses that are using this. They're really using it to educate the students or the young people about what kinds of choices they're going to make in their lives. And of course, there is this struggle with student debt and education and how do you balance that. But there's a lot of intent there around getting young people to think about what is eudaimonia, what is a good life. And then we worked with the city of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where they did random sampling of the population within the university there, University of Wisconsin, and then opt-in with their citizens. They found that time balance they scored lowest. And so one of the things that they did is they put in cultural festivals for that summer to really draw people out and connect them to each other and connect them to their community. They continue to use our index as a platform to give people an understanding of what their role is in a democracy, what their role in government is, something that I think in this country, we just kind of have given that up. And that's an important part of happiness, really, of being involved in your government.
One thing we're doing this year, and we think it maybe will be a much bigger thing next year, but that's to work with communities and a number of colleges on what we call Sustainable Happiness Week. This begins with Pursuit of Happiness Day, which is April 13th. That's the birthday of Thomas Jefferson. It falls on a Saturday. And it lasts up until Earth Day, which is April 22nd officially. So during that week, we are hoping to see communities and colleges focus on the whole idea of sustainable well-being or sustainable happiness and do activities around that. We hope that will take off maybe a little bit bigger in 2014. But we already have a number of colleges that are involved in some communities.
And then here in Seattle, we'll be doing some work during that Sustainable Happiness Week with the Happy Post-it Project. We'll be going out and asking people what makes you happy. So it's called Make It Happy Seattle. And then we'll be doing an event on Earth Day, April 22nd at Seattle City Hall. So from 5 to 7, we'll be giving some of the data and doing some TEDx-style talks with Richard Conlon and some others. So that'll be a lot of fun. But I wanted to say also that in Seattle, last year we worked with some immigrant and refugee communities here in Seattle, where we used the survey to gauge how they compare to the rest of the people in the United States. And we found that in all four communities, and that was the Oromo, Ethiopia, the Somali, the Vietnamese, and the Filipino, they scored lower than the national average on every single domain. And that's frightening. With the Vietnamese Friendship Association, we were working with youth. We were working with people under 19. And so they are continuing. They're using the survey again this year with their youth. And they're really looking at how they can make a change. It's inspiring the youth to see how they can make a change in our greater society.
How receptive overall are government officials in the U.S. to using happiness or well-being indicators?
Well, some are receptive and some as yet are not. We've had some real interest from, for example, the U.S. Public Health Service in the work that we're doing. And I think that is really going to take off again in 2014. The sequester kind of put a little damper on what we were able to do this year with those folks. But we also do have interest from people like the city manager of Eau Claire got interested in other places. Some leaders, the word happiness just strikes them as kind of frivolous and all of that. I think they don't understand what a serious matter this in fact is and how it's connected to all of these other things that we do as a society.
And there's some rumblings from the right that this actually will be the issue of focus in the future. So I think that it's really important when looking at happiness to make that really clear connection between well-being and government and how the purpose of government is the well-being, is the happiness of the people, and to not stand down from that. So the biggest sort of pushback that we get is that the purpose of the government isn't happiness. And that's actually completely contrary to the truth if we look at our own and the intent of our forefathers. And, you know, what is the purpose of government? Is it to make us richer or is it for the well-being of all of us? It kind of makes sense that it's for the well-being of all of us.
To what extent are happiness or well-being indicators being considered and are used by our city government in Seattle?
We would love them to be used more, frankly. You know, we do have some support from the Seattle City Council. But what we would love, and we talked with Richard Conlon about this, what we would love is to be able to develop a tool like they're using in Bhutan, where they have essentially a policy tool and they can rate decisions based on the domains of happiness as well as what our scores are or how we perceive in Seattle area ourselves to be hurting and thriving. But again, this is very much an emerging field.
One thing I want to point out is that there are a number of things that are very important for happiness, and one is greater equality, more of an egalitarian kind of society. We know that the world's happiest countries, which happen to be Denmark, Sweden, Finland, the Netherlands, Norway, and so forth, are countries where the gap between rich and poor is very small. We also see that in the United States. We see that the three happiest states, Hawaii, Colorado, and Minnesota, are states that have a very small gap between rich and poor. They are also the three healthiest states in the United States. The order is slightly reversed. Colorado number one, Hawaii number two, and Minnesota again number three. Now, if we look at the bottom, at the least happy and healthy states in the United States, we find that the least healthy, happy state is West Virginia, second least happy and healthy is Kentucky, and third Mississippi. These are all states that have tremendous gaps between rich and poor, and they also have great exploitation of natural resources, things like mountaintop mining, all of these kind of things. So we have an idea that equality matters for happiness.
And I think that follows to the issue around, does money make us happier? So maybe the purpose of government is to make us richer because money is what makes us happier. Well, there's something called the Easterlin paradox, which says that after a salary of about $75,000 for the people in the United States for a family of four, and of course that's an average, one's happiness doesn't increase that much. So it's very small, if any, increases in happiness. And there's also research that was done by Richard Layard, who was instrumental in getting Cameron, the Prime Minister of the UK, to make happiness what he says is his legacy, that says that while GDP tripled since 1950s, since per capita GDP doubled since 1960s, so the gross domestic product, which is everything that we produce within a year, people's happiness hasn't really increased that much. In some populations, it's actually decreased. Now, there's some pushback on that research that says that Easterlin isn't correct and that the more money that you make, the happier you are. But if you look at the data, the long-term data, and if you look at the long-term research, you'll see that the Easterlin paradox pretty much always comes out Of course, there's going to be a lot of pushback as this movement takes more a hold, because that means that the powers that be, that the thinking that is in place has to be dispelled. And we can look at any change. There's always going to be pushback on that. And there will always be ways to say, oh, well, it's not true that more money will make you happier. But really, it comes down to, and you asked the question before about policymakers, it comes down to people, and it comes down to who we are. And as much as the science can tell you something about the Eastern paradox, or the science can tell you about community, happiness is at our very core. It's about who we are and why we're here, why we live. And so we can sort of truth test on that. So you can just take a moment and say to yourself, what really does make me happy? And I doubt it's going to be money. I doubt you're going to say, when I die, I want a big dollar signs on my gravestone. It's probably going to be people. It's probably going to be things like love, caring for others and being cared for, caring for the planet, and feeling that you have left the planet a better place.
And we have to keep in mind that regardless of this, I mean, even if millionaires do show up as being a fraction, a tiny bit happier than people who make $50,000 or $75,000 a year, the point is that kind of thing is not sustainable. We cannot just simply grow and keep growing and adding money. We have to find a way to live on this planet in a sustainable fashion. We have to find ways to be happy without consuming more and more stuff and having incomes grow and grow forever, because the Earth will not allow that.
Our planet is going into crisis. Fortunately, in Seattle, we live in one of the best places there is to live when we look at climate change and the other crises that are coming. But the crises are coming and they're already there in places, which means that we're going to have to learn how to adapt. We're going to have to learn how to be okay with less and with very changing circumstances. So let's look a little forward on that. And what are we going to need in a time of crisis? And there's a great book out there called Paradise Built in Hell, which talks about what happens when there is crisis. And what happens is community. It's giving. It's taking care of each other. And that's part of that shift of going from a money-based society to a well-being-based society.
What do you see as the key leverage points to bring about increased happiness and well-being in our society?
There's a blend. Our project is really about policy and changing policy, but that doesn't mean that we leave behind what's called the positive psychology field or the personal piece. So it's a blend of both people spending more time thinking about what makes them happy, and then that blend of working at the bottoms-up approach of changing the indicators that we're using. Because in this society, we're not yet at the place that we can be just purely guided by values and ethics and morals. We need to use that stepping stone of using a different measure to help change our thinking.
Let me tell a very tiny story to summarize the idea that sometimes we don't know what will make us happy, and we often think, in fact, we usually think that more money is the thing that will make us happy. So when workers in a county in California called Amador County in 2009 were faced with layoffs and keeping the same hours and their wages versus shortening work time and sharing work and having a little less pay, at first they wanted to lay people off. They wanted to keep what they had. And when they were told they couldn't do that, that they had to share the work so that everybody could stay employed, work 4 days a week instead of five and take a little less money, they were outraged by that. 2 years later, the same workers offered the choice of going back to a five-day work week at full pay or staying at 4 days with less pay, voted 71% to 29% to stay with a shorter work week with less pay. They found in that time that they really loved that day off, the time spent with family, the time spent with nature, the things that they could do. And I think that shows us that we don't always know what's going to make us happy. We choose the money, but sometimes choosing the time and the friends and the connection and all of that is the thing we ought to be doing.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Laura Musikansky and John DeGraff, co-founders of the Happiness Initiative. For more information, check on the web at happycounts.org. Again, that's happycounts.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.